you got, Sarah?
I also have Iowa State winning the men's. And of course, I have Iowa winning the women's. And apparently so do 37 other states in the country, majority brackets. I also was close to the top on the Quad City Times bracket once Duquesne beat BYU, but then quickly fell after last night's Kentucky upset.
Oh, yeah. So. Well, I got a feeling that one hurt a lot of people. I wonder how many Iowans picked with their heart and got dinged by the Drake game last night, too. That's too bad. All right, Jared McNett of the Sioux City Journal is with us. What do you got for us, Jared?
Aaron, since I don't have a rooting interest this year, my sole purpose is to see the college located in Lawrence, Kansas, lose in humiliating fashion.
You know, and the good thing about that is usually they come through for it.
Oh, yes, they do. Yes, they do.
And finally, Gazette columnist Todd Dormer is here. What do you got, Todd?
I'm going with Oakland all the way.
Well, you're off to a good start. I couldn't pick my Badgers if I wanted to. I didn't fill out a bracket, so I'm going to take the lazy man's way out and pick UConn to repeat. Such a sad. Yeah, Jared's shaking his head. That's fair. Harsh, but fair. But go Badgers. They tip off 9:40 local time in Brooklyn tonight. I can imagine the New York City crowd is going to really rush out at 9:40 to go see Wisconsin versus James Madison. Great scheduling there. All right, let's get to the task at hand, and let's start this week on the political side of things. This past week brought the filing deadline for candidates running in the state's June 4th primary elections for state and federal offices. There are some interesting contested primaries out there worth noting, so let's take a quick trip around the horn here and talk about those. And Jared, kick us off. You have a few primaries you'll be watching in Northwest Iowa. Tell us about those.
That's right, Aaron. The biggest ticket item, which we have talked about before, Randy Feenstra, the two-term incumbent who replaced Steve King, he's being primaried by Kevin Virgil, who's an Army vet from Sutherland. And as I've also mentioned before, Virgil's being backed by Steve King. So if you believe in the power of endorsements even a little bit, that could make things a little bit interesting come the June primary. Feenstra is not the only Northwest Iowa incumbent Republican that's being primaried in June. Mike Sexton, who's a representative from Rockwell City, he will face a challenge. He's being primaried by Wendy Lou Larson, who's an Otebolt resident, running in part on going after the improper use of eminent domain. She's also listed illegal immigration, indoctrination of children in public schools, and anti-Second Amendment laws as some of her other items that she's campaigning on. So she's maybe trying to out-conservative Sexton, it seems. The eminent domain thing, that's a platform we've seen other primary and general election candidates run on in our area. In 22, I know I talked about this a bunch, John Wills was challenged almost solely on the issue of eminent domain. That was like the main thing his opponent ran on in the general. And I was kind of wondering, since we're doing this, did anyone else in their part of the state have any candidates that have really already started staking a claim on that for this cycle too?
It doesn't look like it. Seeing a lot of shaking heads. That is interesting though, Jared. Well, first of all, two things I wanted to follow up with you on that, and I didn't know that, so thanks for those.
Mm-hmm.
Sexton, first of all, is not exactly a backbencher. I mean, they put him in charge of a number of bills. And as I say that, I couldn't think of any high-profile ones off the top of my head necessarily. The one that comes to mind, just because it's most recent, is I know he ran the meat labeling bill, the meat substitute labeling. But anyways, just the point being, he's not just one of those members of the House that sits at their desk and you never really hear from him. You know, he's prominent, so it's interesting to hear him have a primary challenger. And you mentioned Wills. Do you remember, I apologize for putting you on the spot, Jared, do you remember how close that challenged?
It ended up not being that close, but for someone who had like no name ID, they acquitted themselves about as well as they probably could have.
Yeah, okay.
I don't necessarily know that it's that surprising that we're seeing some of these primary challenges, because when it's this like conservative dominated part of a state, if you ever want to get elected, you're just going to have to go up against a Republican at some point. It's not going to be the same as another you know, states or in other more competitive areas. So
your elections for some of those offices are June 4th, not in November, yep. Right?
Yeah.
I was just going to note on the eminent domain primaries, Waylon Brown has a primary challenger. He's the senator who is in charge of the Commerce Committee and has been the subject of a lot of the anger from the eminent domain opponents. I don't know much about his challenger, Doug Campbell, but a quick Facebook search shows that he is engaged on the eminent domain issue and is opposed to eminent domain for carbon pipelines. So I imagine that's going to be a big part of his campaign.
Yeah. The other most interesting race for us is probably the race for the House District 13 seat, where that's also two GOP candidates competing against each other. That's going to be an open seat because the guy who currently holds it, Ken Carlson, who's only in his first term, decided not to run for re-election. And so the two guys running for it are Noah Wiesler from Sioux City and Travis Sitzman from Lamar's. And at least so far, from just the initial releases they sent out, I haven't seen a lot from either of them that's that markedly different in terms of the policies they're kind of advancing. So for now, that feels like a coin toss. And then in the fall, we've got five races where there'll be incumbent state legislators being challenged by opponents from the other party, including J.D. Shulton, Northwest Iowa's lone Democratic state legislature. He's being challenged by a fellow Sioux Cityan who's a baseball coach. So we've got some we've got some baseball on baseball action going on in that one.
Some hardball on hardball violence there. Wow.
Yeah. That campaign maybe will come down to Shulton pitching to Josh Steinhoff. And if Steinhoff can hit it, then he wins. If Shulton strikes him out, then Shulton stays in the legislature.
It'll take him 3 months to agree on an umpire, though. That'll be the key. Calling the balls and strikes. All right. Thanks, Jared. Some interesting stuff there. Sarah, been into the opposite side of the state. It sounds like June 4th will be a relatively quiet day at the state house level anyways in the Quad City Times. But you do have one congressional primary to watch, and we've talked about that before on the podcast. But remind folks and tell us about that one again.
Yeah, so Marionette Miller Meeks faces a primary challenger from the right, David Patch, a minister and founder of the Quad Cities Prayer Breakfast. He's hosted that for several years now and has hosted guests such as Carrie Lake, Mike Lindell. He's staked out a very conservative religious lane for the primary in June. And obviously, yeah, Marionette Miller Meeks, our current representative, is seeking her third term. So that'll be the main race to watch here in Southeast Iowa for June. And Scott County and Muscatine County and Clinton County are like three county area. There are no primaries for state house races. And really probably the most interesting thing that I found at the state level out of the filings was who didn't file. Luana Stoltenberg announced here a month or two ago that she would not be running for reelection. And so there was not any Republican that filed for that House seat. There is a Democrat, Dan Gosa, a school board member and union leader. So obviously, the Republican Party can still nominate someone at convention, but if for some reason they don't, that could potentially be a flipped seat. Certainly, there will be a new representative there, obviously.
If they don't, that would be malpractice of the highest degree on local Republicans' part, because that was a really competitive race for Stoltenberg, right? She won by literally single digits. Am I remembering that right?
Right. Yeah. Well, I think the final count was after a little bit more than that, but it was super close. Narrow. There was lots of recounts. It was, yeah. We didn't know the answer until about a month after the election. So yes, that was a very competitive race. I am expecting the Republicans to nominate someone.
Yeah, you would sure assume. By the way, that's just quick tangent here, and I apologize for making the podcast a little longer for y'all trying to squeeze it into your commute. But that just reminded me when you mentioned the recounts. It baffles me, and I need to talk to Bobby Kaufman and whoever's managing on the Senate side. We've got this massive elections bill that deals with all this stuff that you could argue a lot of people suggest is not even needed. Meanwhile, over the last three cycles, we've had how many messy recounts in both state house and congressional races, agreement across the board that we need to standardize, streamline, perfect our recount system. And there's widespread bipartisan agreement on that. And that is not in that elections bill. So we're doing all this other stuff with the early voting, but meanwhile we're letting our mess of a recount system go unfixed. That's I have questions. I'll leave it at that.
Sarah, it might be a little too early for me to ask this, but has Christina Bohannon already been kind of running like she's going to be facing off against Marionette Miller-Meeks again, or has there been kind of hedging? Yeah. Okay. I was wondering 100%. If there's some hedging maybe for if Meeks somehow loses the primary.
No, not at all. I get an email at least two or three times a week from the Bohannon campaign talking about Miller Meeks did this related to abortion or supported this position related to abortion. So no, they are definitely positioning themselves to run against Miller Meeks. And really, to be honest, I mean, David Patch is fairly well known in the Quad Cities, but outside of that, I don't think he has a lot of name recognition. And even in the Quad Cities, I mean, it's mostly like in the most conservative circles at that Quad Cities prayer breakfast and in religious circles.
Yeah. The DCCC also seems to think that it'll be Marionette Miller-Meeks that's going to win that primary. I get emails from them, if not every day, at least every other day. Same type of thing as Sarah talked about from the Bohannon campaign, pointing out, you know, Miller-Meeks did this, Miller-Meeks supported this. Anyway,
sounds like it's a good thing that I'm not the target of some of those email lists. That's not a complaint out there, campaign spokespeople. I'm fine. I'm good. Don't worry about me. All right, Tom, Caleb, finish us up here. Anything outside of those Eastern and Iowa seats that looked interesting on the primary ballot?
Yeah, one interesting race I noticed, I think the House District 34, and that's Akeo Abdul-Samad's seat. He's a Democrat representing Des Moines. He's retiring this year after almost 20 years in the legislature. And there's four Democrats that have filed for that seat. I don't know, recognize the names of any of them. I don't know how many of them are major Democratic politicians in the city. I don't know if there's one that's kind of the clear, obvious, likely going to win. But it seems like there's a lot of people who have been wanting to represent that district for a long time because it has been held for quite a long time. So that'll be interesting to see.
Yeah, I'm honestly surprised it's only four. That's when some of those Des Moines seats, when they open up like that, I'd have to look back. But there was one very recently here where I think there were six Democrats that filed for the primary in one of the Des Moines seats.
And that is probably another one of those that, like those Western Iowa seats, that primary is going to be the more competitive election.
Yeah, absolutely. Tom, anything else? Or
maybe a couple of races I would note really quick. Two Republicans will face off for a open House seat representing all of Iowa County and parts of Johnson County. So State Representative Brad Sherman from Williamsburg is not seeking re-election. He's already endorsed one of the Republicans running in that race, Judd Lawler, and kind of recruited or encouraged him to run when he decided that he wouldn't be seeking re-election. It's kind of a sad deal, sad situation. Representative Sherman had a death in the family, and because of that, is not going to be seeking re-election as you know, he and his wife kind of deal with that. Democrats will compete in a three-way primary for the opportunity to take on a six-term Republican incumbent from Tama County. That's State Representative Dean Fisher of Montour. And then an Iowa City incumbent state representative drew a primary challenger. State Representative Eleanor Levin drew a Democratic challenger, although I don't know whether that is going to be a competitive primary. She faces Democratic primary challenger Ty Bopp, an assistant store manager at Hy-Vee in Iowa City, is a 2021 graduate of Cornell College, and had also filed in 2022 to run for Iowa House District 92 in Johnson and Washington counties, but dropped out of the race in April before the primary. But his name still appeared on the June primary ballot because he had filed all of his paperwork. Again, not sure how competitive that primary is going to be, but yeah.
All right. And I'm just going to add two quick ones here, and one that probably didn't get mentioned because as I always like to tell people, it's so odd to be based in Des Moines and working out of Des Moines, and we don't cover the third district. So that's probably why it didn't come up here, because none of the Gazette or Lee papers have circulation area in the third district. But there is a Democratic primary in the race to take on first term Republican incumbent Zach Nunn. You have Landon Say it again. I had to ask this last time. Bakam? Woohoo! Nailed it this time. I got it wrong last time. I remember. He's the what appears to be the party favorite, a huge list of endorsements. The D-Trip is supporting him, if I remember right. Thank you. Tom's nodding his head. Yes. And then there's another Democrat, a local nonprofit leader, Melissa Vine. The thumb seems to be on the scale for that one, but there is a primary. We'll see what it looks like. And then in the State House, again, it's not any in our areas, but it's just going to be an interesting one to watch. It looks like it must be an open district. I'm trying to remember who's Tom or Caleb, look up State Representative House District 22 for me to see who's the retiring incumbent there. But there's there's a Democrat declared, and then there's a Republican primary between Samantha Fett and Garrett Gobble. So for those of you who don't consume legislative news every waking moment of your day, like some of us are cursed to, Garrett Gobble is a former state representative from Ankeny who now lives in Norwalk. So he's running again. And Samantha Fett from Carlisle is one of the foremost Moms for Liberty activists that's been involved at the State House in the past couple of years on all the issues that group's been involved in. So that's a fascinating Republican primary right there between two folks who have their various attachments to the Iowa legislature. Did you guys find it? Who's District 22 right now?
Stan Gustafson.
Okay, so Stan's retiring. There we go. Stan Gustafson, who's been in, I'd have to look it up to know exactly, but he's been in the legislature for a while. So his retirement opening up what's going to be a really interesting Republican primary there. And then there is a Democratic candidate from Norwalk for the general election. I don't know without looking at it how that district leans for the general election. But like I said, a very, very interesting Republican primary there. Let's move on. So obviously, as the June 7th primary comes closer, we'll circle back on some of those races. But for now, let's take things back to the State House, where it was another interesting week for the AEA debate. And we'll get to that. But first, let's real quick cover a couple other bills that were moved by House Republicans this week. First, eminent domain is back in the legislative sphere once again. It's not just an election issue, it's also a legislative issue. House Republicans advanced their bill, which is now moving in the House Ways and Means Committee, chaired by Bobby Kaufman. Tom, you covered that hearing this week. Tell us about how strongly House Republicans feel about this issue and whether anything has changed in the Senate, which to this point has not shown a whole lot of interest in eminent domain legislation.
Yeah, so I think we've talked about this on a previous podcast. You know, it's no secret House Republicans' frustration with Senate Republicans not passing bills that they're sending over to the other chamber. Either killing or shelving them, or just not really taking any action on them. And this is one of them that has really kind of upset and rankled House Republicans that this is something that Senate Republicans have, kind of refused to advance. And so, this is kind of, for lack of a better term, they're shot across the bow, urging Senate Republicans to, do something to help protect property owners who are being potentially impacted by these proposed carbon capture pipelines. So the bill that House lawmakers advanced, it would allow landowners who are affected by a eminent domain proceeding before the Iowa Utilities Board to petition a court for a declaratory order to determine their rights and the constitutionality of the eminent domain request. So it kind of reorders the process. The court would be able to determine before the Iowa Utilities Board makes a final decision whether the use of eminent domain to involuntarily take land for these proposed pipeline projects is warranted, and then that decision could be appealed to higher courts. Representative Bobby Kaufman, who chairs the House Ways and Means Committee, a Republican from Wilton, said that believes that both the landowners as well as the private companies pursuing these projects deserve the right to know ahead of time if eminent domain is actually something that is applicable for that project so that, you know, months, if not years of kind of stress, financial strains and lawyers' fees are not wasted if in the end a declaratory judgment for eminent domain is never going to happen. And that's the concern, the frustration by these landowners that, you know, where the pipelines are proposed to run through their property. You know, they've been for the last roughly 3 years petitioning lawmakers, petitioning the Iowa Utilities Board, you know, driving back and forth to Des Moines, as well as Fort Dodge, where there was a 8-week evidentiary hearing on one of the proposed pipelines, and, you know, spending money on attorney's fees, you know, and all the while not really knowing kind of what's going to happen or how things are going to shake out with regards to that eminent domain piece. And so this was, it was a bipartisan vote. It passed out of the committee, I think 23-0. So something that has support not only of House Republicans, but House Democrats as well. And I think Representative Kaufman said something to the effect, you know, again, needling Senate Republicans saying, look, House Republicans, House Democrats are going to stand up for property owners, for property rights. You know, we're going to protect them. The bill failed to make it through the legislative funnel. And so in order to keep this alive and to keep this as a quote unquote live round for the rest of the session, they moved this bill through the Ways and Means Committee. As we've said, I think in previous episodes, you know, budget bills, appropriations bills, tax policy, Ways and Means bills are immune from the funnel. Again, House lawmakers needling the Senate to try and get something done on this issue.
Yeah. And to that, it'll be interesting. I'll preface this by saying it's not necessarily the right person in the bigger picture of this, but it was interesting. We asked Dawson, Senator Dan Dawson, about this on Iowa Press. Check it out this weekend, tonight and Sunday. And he didn't outright rule out that bill, which is noteworthy. Now, like I said, Dan Dawson isn't the one who's been holding it up in the Senate. We talked about Senator Brown before. He's been opposed to those bills in the past, and obviously it ultimately comes down to Senator Whitford. But for what it was worth, and he is chairman of the committee that this bill would bounce to, because it's, as Tom mentioned, it's a Ways and Means bill, and Dan Dawson chairs the Ways and Means Committee in the Senate. When we asked him about this bill, he said, and I'm going to basically read his quote here, "I think it's a unique way of going about it, maybe compared to some proposals last year." And then he acknowledges it's a priority for the House. He goes on to say some different things on either side of the bill, and then wraps it up with saying, "But I think it's definitely something to take a look at." So that was interesting. I mean, that shows at least a little more interest from the Senate this side. So it'll be interesting if maybe this is the year that they finally are willing to look at something on eminent domain in compared to recent years.
And that's another thing that Representative Kaufman, the chair of the House Ways and Means Committee, mentioned. This is kind of a new tactic, or maybe a new strategy for House Republicans to try and get Senate support compared to previous proposals, arguing that this bill wouldn't stop the pipelines. You know, it wouldn't put up additional barriers for,
like, for the permitting process.
For the permitting process, right? Again, it just kind of changes the order of the process to, in their view, better protect property rights, kind of putting that up front of at the process as opposed to the back end.
Yeah.
And so that potentially could be more palatable for support in the Senate.
Yeah.
Of course, another thing to keep in mind that's always front of mind for us, since we're in a tri-state area that with these plans, is this is not a done deal in the other states that these routes would go through for these pipelines. At the county level, even, there's still a lot of pushback from, like, planning and zoning boards and, you know, supervisors and all that sort of thing. So,
Jared, which of the Dakotas is it that just recently there was some big hurdles put up on one of these projects? And I apologize if I'm putting you on the spot and you missed that.
No. The bigger hurdles have been in North Dakota. Okay. As of late. Yeah.
Yeah. Interesting stuff. On another topic, and after a couple of big bills on this subject died in the funnel, one immigration bill did pass the Iowa House this week, and it's now on its way to Governor Reynolds' desk. This bill would allow state law enforcement officials to arrest and order the removal of individuals who are not legal U.S. residents. And that's a super simplification explanation of the bill. Check out one of our stories to get the full explanation. But and maybe Caleb can elaborate a little bit more, because you covered that one and tell us about that bill passing.
Yeah, so this bill adds or creates a crime of criminal reentry. So it's specifically for people who enter the U.S. and specifically the state of Iowa after having previously been asked either turned away at the border or deported from either from this Iowa or just anywhere in the U.S. And so this would allow the state law enforcement to arrest and charge somebody who is in the state illegally, and then that would trigger court proceedings. And during those court proceedings, the judge could order the person to be returned to their country of origin. That would stop the court proceedings. And so that essentially the person would have the option to spend 5 to 10 years in jail, depending on what their charge was, or return to their country of origin. Immigration enforcement has historically and is usually a federal issue. This is something that the federal government carries out. But Republicans have been, during Joe Biden's presidency, increasingly critical of his enforcement at the southern border. And they are saying that, you know, we've seen a record number of illegal border crossings and states need to begin to act and take the enforcement into their own hands. It's very similar to a law that Texas passed that has been passed, but is currently, it's been going back and forth, but I think right now it is currently blocked by a federal appeals court. President Biden's administration and some other groups have challenged it. And so it will be going through those court proceedings and may end up with the Supreme Court. And what that what the decision of that ends up being could affect how Iowa's law, if it becomes law, which Governor Reynolds has said she's going to sign it, could end up affecting how that is enforced or if it's, you know, considered constitutional. As I said, the Republicans say that it's needed to address the increasing illegal border crossings. But we've also seen a number of immigration activists and immigrants come to the state house over the last few months to argue against the bill and similar bills like it, saying that they're discriminatory, that they create fear and a culture of fear in immigrant communities and just make those places more dangerous and people more reluctant to help immigrants and things like that. So it's been an interesting issue all around. There's obviously, as you mentioned, Aaron, been several proposals that have come up, but this one is the first one that's actually been sent to the governor's desk.
Yep, and they say they don't, their line is always, we don't forecast legal strategy, but the ACLU had a press release that issued shortly after the bill passed, calling it unconstitutional. So if it is signed into law, the crystal ball seems to have a little bit of a clear vision there of what might happen.
The Eastern Iowa immigrant rights group, Escucha Mi Voz, said pretty clearly that they plan to challenge it in court as well. So
there you go.
There's also, I guess, practical concerns with the bill and how you actually go about implementing it, because it talks about for courts that issue a removal order, you know, somebody who violates the law, you know, who illegally reenters the United States, that they would have to be removed to a port of entry. And so the question becomes, okay, what is the cost of that going to be? How do you actually go about that? How do you transport them there? Who's going to be responsible for transporting them and ensuring compliance with that? It's worth noting that the fiscal note from the legislative nonpartisan legislative service agency noted that, you know, it's difficult and they couldn't estimate, you know, what that cost would be, but that it could potentially be significant for these removal orders to take someone to a port of entry. And I think, Aaron, you mentioned the statement from the ACLU. I believe that in that statement, they talked about, you know, look, Iowa law enforcement, Iowa's court system isn't set up to handle immigration cases. You know, the court system and Iowa law enforcement doesn't really have the resources and the legal expertise to deal with, you know, the intricacies and the nuances of federal immigration law. And so, yeah, it's going to be interesting, you know, if this does get signed into law, how they go about actually navigating ways to implement it and, you know, the issues and the challenges that presents.
This is on the Texas law. I don't think we've seen Mexico officials weigh in on Iowa's law, but Mexico state officials have said that they're not going to accept immigrants that are sent back over the border by Texas officials. So it is definitely becoming a tricky logistical and legal issue.
It's almost as if this is a very complex issue and a very complex problem that requires very thoughtful in complex solutions. Crazy thought there. All right, let's move on to the main event. It's AEA's once again. Way back on Tuesday this week, which at this point feels like about 3 weeks ago, Iowa Senate Republicans passed their version of AEA changes in a bill that is much closer aligned to Governor Kim Reynolds' proposal. And it certainly goes much further than the bill passed by House Republicans a week or so ago, or 2 months ago, or a decade ago, whenever that was. So that planting of the legislative flag would have been enough on its own to merit discussion here on the podcast. But it turns out the topic was only getting warmed up, because on Wednesday, we started to hear whispers that a deal had been reached between House and Senate Republicans and Governor Reynolds. And then on Thursday, we got the official word eventually that they were going to debate in the Iowa House an AEA bill. And long story short, we spent all day waiting to find out what it might look like. Around, boy, I don't know, what, 3 or 4 o'clock, we finally got the official amendment that was going to become the bill. And shortly after they started debating, Republicans put a hard deadline on debate for 6:30. And by 7 o'clock, the thing was passed and on its way back to the Senate. The super succinct description here is that if you've been following this process the whole way, the latest proposal, the quote unquote compromise proposal that the House passed Thursday night, was very close to its original bill, far closer to the House bill than it was to the Senate. And it also included a 2.5% SSA increase for school funding and a boost in minimum salaries for beginning and veteran teachers. Todd, let me start with you here. I'm curious if you had any thoughts, maybe just first kind of through the political lens of the House and Chuck, Pat Grassley's words immediately after debate were the literal words were final offer. This is House Republicans saying, this is it, take it or leave it. And so now it's on Senate Republicans to, if you take Pat Grassley at his word, either pass this bill or you're not going to get an AEA bill. I'm just curious if you have any thoughts on the way this played out procedurally and politically speaking, here this week.
Well, it's kind of, gather around and let me tell you a story about two legislative chambers whose leaders do not like each other very much, and that causes problems. I mean, the first thing that strikes you about the House vote is that their bill got 51 votes. There were a lot of Republican defections.
Nine Republicans voted against it. Yep.
Yeah, and that may be why Pat's saying a final offer, because if they take anything back to the floor that looks anything like what the Senate wants to do, then they're going to lose more votes. I mean, and the House bill is they want to prune the AEA system, whereas the Senate bill and the governor, they want to yank it out by the roots and do a much more dramatic redesign. I suppose they could go, the old fashioned route and do an actual conference committee, which is fairly rare. They like to negotiate behind closed doors mainly. So
Todd, just real quick, I love the use of the word conference committee, because for about 80% of the State House press corps, they've never even heard that term because there hasn't been one in so long.
Yeah, there were a few when I was covering the legislature. They, it was an open process. I mean, that was when there was the dual split control of the parties. And so that's, whatever comes out of the conference committee, you put it on the floor, it can't be amended and has to go up and down. And so, but I doubt that's going to happen in this situation. Yes. But I guess the only question is, how long do you keep trying to get a compromise? Do you delay adjournment to keep working on that? Or do you kind of realize that the governor's vision and the vision of House Republicans are so far apart that, a deal is not going to get made? So the other thing in the way is that, Iowa State may play other basketball games yet in the NCAA tournament. So that gets in the way of debate. Wasn't the time certain at like tip off yesterday for when they ended debate?
Yeah, it was set for 6:30, which was really uncomfortably coincidentally close to tip off of the Iowa State game. And Laura Bellin of Bleeding Heartland asked Speaker Grassley about that, and Pat played it off, take him or leave him, at his word, saying that he doesn't even pay attention to the brackets. He doesn't fill out a bracket anymore, so he doesn't know what time games are tipping off. Like I said, believe him or not, but that was the response to that question.
Certainly that wouldn't play in. I can, you know, that'd be bad form, wouldn't it? But yeah, I guess bottom line, I'm skeptical at this moment that they're going to be able to overcome their differences and pass a bill. I'm betting that they may do what a lot of people wish they would have done ahead of the session, and that's create some sort of panel to make recommendations and include teachers and educators and parents and all of the stakeholders.
I believe I heard that suggested by Democrats at some point in debate, either once or 350 times.
Yeah, yeah. So, maybe they won't even do that much, but...
Sorry, real quick, Todd, you don't think the Senate's going to pass this? Is that what you're saying?
I don't think this is close enough to what they want that they will, yeah. But...
I mean, I don't know the answer. I'm genuinely curious. That wasn't a loaded question. I'm genuinely curious what you think, because I don't know. It'll be interesting next
week. Well, it's, you know, a lot of times when they reach a deal like that, they sort of, the House will pass it, and maybe the Senate is passing the same bill simultaneously, and they ram it through and they get it down to the governor before anybody changes their mind. And so I think it's pretty clear this time that they don't have that kind of agreement to do that. And so that makes it messy. And like I say, they have to decide. I mean, if the Senate, you know, comes down from its position, then yeah, I suppose a compromise is possible. But at this point, their quotes were very sort of cagey. They didn't endorse the House plan, but they also didn't reject it out of hand.
Right. The one case, you know, as I try to play out the hypotheticals in my mind, the one case I could make for the Senate passing the bill as passed by the House is just to be done with the issue. And honestly, you could look, I'm not trying to read into, and it's going to sound like maybe reading into a quote that was just passed along on a piece of paper. But part of Jack Whitford's statement issued after the bill released, it ended with, "And I'm looking forward to resolution on these issues," which again, now I'm projecting a little bit. I'm trying to interpret here, but I can't help but hear a little bit of, I want to be done with this topic.
Well,
for this session, I want to move on and talk about something else, for the love of God. Maybe I'm misinterpreting that, but I can't help but hear a little bit of that.
Yeah. And the wild card is, you know, the governor wants something big very badly. Will lawmakers have the courage to sort of walk away from that and do less?
Yeah. Spin is no new thing in politics. They could pass this bill as passed by the House, and the governor can spin it as a huge deal. And I mean, she kind of did in their statement last night too, right? So that's feasible. Yeah. I mean, it's going to be interesting. I don't know what's going to happen when the Senate comes back next week and takes a look at that. And obviously we'll be talking about this on the podcast next week too.
Well, and maybe further complicating things, and correct me if I'm wrong, I think Mackenzie Snow, the director of the Iowa Department of Education, is up for a confirmation hearing or vote, I think, early next week in the Senate on Tuesday, right?
I miss that. I mean, I know she would be at some point this session before they adjourn. I missed that. If that's on the schedule, you may be very, very right. I will say that Democrats are so far down in numbers in the Senate now, they can't even kill those with the opposition, but they can at least send a signal. And if any Republicans were to peel off, that nomination would be in trouble. But yeah, that would be interesting too, timing wise. Jared, you look like you had something to toss in there.
Yeah. Did I see right that the yes votes for this new round of House voting were even fewer than the last time around? Yeah. I'm trying to think of other recent examples we've talked about of that happening with a bill this big, where when it comes back around, the yes votes bleed off even a little bit more like that.
Yeah. That is not very often. And especially when it's already this close to begin with. And that speaks to Todd's point. I think that he made a lot of great points, but the biggest one was that, look, this passed with 51. They literally, at this point, cannot lose another vote. So one more vote and it goes away. And that 51 is with people like Chad Ingalls and Brent Segrist voting for it as yes votes. And they have expressed on the floor at different points in the process heartburn even with their yes votes. So if you change it too much more, it's obviously not going to pass the House. And these aren't malleable votes in here in this House in Republican caucus on this issue. the no votes are no votes. You're not flipping them back to yeses. The people who have their feelings on this, it's very strong, and it's not moving in that direction. You're not going to get any back, so you can't lose any more yeses. Mm-hmm. And that's why, to your point, Todd, if the Senate doesn't take this and wants to pass something that's another compromise but another notch above, it won't pass the House.
Well, I think it was telling when the Speaker, the milliseconds it took between the 51st vote and when he closed the machine.
Yes, I noticed that too. Yep. And for it's people like... who don't follow this, the reason for that is until the machine closes, you can change your vote. If you've clicked yes and you have a quick change of heart for whatever reason, if the machine hasn't closed yet, you can flip that back to a no. And so, to Todd's point, when it hit 51 on the board last night, the board closed pretty quickly. Man, I mean, it's a fascinating topic. And as I say, always, we get focused on the politics because the politics are interesting. Keep in mind, we haven't lost sight that this is important stuff, important policy that affects a lot of people in some of the most important ways. I mean, we're talking about special education services here in a big way. So please make sure you see all our coverage on this story too, where we over the weeks and months have really dived into that stuff and the impact it would have on Iowa students and families. I want to make sure that that's clear, that we're not losing sight of that. But yeah, it sounds like it's coming up in the Senate this week, more likely than not. So we'll be back here talking about AEAs again on next week's podcast. But that's it for this edition. We hope you enjoyed it. If you're not already, please subscribe to us on your streaming service of choice. And remember, you can also find the podcast each week on your preferred Gazette or Lee newspaper website. Now that you've listened to the On Iowa Politics podcast, make sure you're also subscribed to the On Iowa Politics newsletter, where every morning in your inbox, you'll receive all the latest politics and government coverage from our team. You can subscribe to that free newsletter at the Gazette's website, thegazette.com. And lastly, don't forget that the work of everyone you heard here today can be found on the pages and websites of the Quad City Times, Muscatine Journal, Cedar Rapids Gazette, Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier, Mason City Globe Gazette, Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil, and the Sioux City Journal. Free by Tone DeBoss is playing us out this week. If you know an Iowa band or musician who should be featured on the podcast, please send us a sound file. For the full roster this week, Tom Barton, Caleb McCullough, Sarah Watson, Jared McNett, Todd Dorman, and our producer, Bailey Chihan, I'm Aaron Murphy. Thanks for listening.
Can't get enough of the Gazette? Listen to the Gazette Daily News podcast for the latest Eastern Iowa headlines packed into bite-sized stories. Listen at thegazette.com or Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, or through your Amazon Alexa device. Tell it to enable the Gazette Daily News skill, then say, "Alexa, what's my flash briefing?"